Welcome back to another episode of Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I discuss the various pathways that lead to a profession in psychedelic-assisted therapy. How does one become a psychedelic therapist? We talk about the twists and turns of our own paths to this profession, why people might want to pursue this specialty and why they might not want to. We talk about different training opportunities, including those associated with clinical trials. We'll discuss the Numinous Psychedelic Therapy Certification Pathway, how different licensed professionals can get involved, non-licensed paths to psychedelic work, and much, much more. Speaking of training, there is still time to sign up for the Numinous Fundamentals of Psychedelic Assisted Therapy course. The next cohort begins October 24th, 2023, so click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/our-training-selection, and you can use the code PTF10 for 10% off the training. Speaking of clinical trials, if you or someone you know is interested in being a participant in a psychedelic clinical trial, you can click on the other link in our show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn about the trials that we're currently running. As always, if you'd like to show support for the show, you can do so by leaving us a rating or review in places like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Those ratings do a lot to help put the show in front of more eyeballs. And Reed and I would love to continue offering this free education resource to people. So if you haven't already, please leave us a review. Now I bring you our conversation on how to become a psychedelic therapist. And we're back. Another episode of Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers.
Hello, Steve.
How you doing, Reed?
Very well, thanks.
Good.
How are you today?
You know what? I'm also doing really well. Had a great weekend. Ready to tackle this week with renewed vigor. Is vim a word? Something like that.
I don't know the answer to that.
Well, if it's not, I made it up. Trademark.
Vim?
Vim, vigor. That sounds like something from like Hocus Pocus. I'm remembering a cartoon witch saying something. Maybe in the Sword of the Stone. I don't know. How's that
help
for
listeners?
Google it. Let us know. So today we get a lot of questions about how one can become a psychedelic therapist. Like, what are the training opportunities? What are the communities of support that help people who are interested in this profession? So we thought we'd go for it. We'd tackle it head on and talk about some of the resources that are out there for people.
And there are many. And there are also many people just saying, hey, I'm a psychedelic therapist or facilitator.
Right.
Just one day out of the blue. So
yeah.
how do you evaluate this? I guess we're gearing this conversation mostly to those interested in working in the space, right? Mm-hmm. But useful for everyone, especially if you're seeking psychedelic therapy, to know where your team comes from.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is the name of our podcast. We're both licensed therapists. There's so we have a bias towards psychedelic assisted therapy, and we've made statements like this in the podcast a lot, but there's a lot of different ways to use psychedelic tools. Some of them have been used in like, for example, ceremonial or indigenous contexts for thousands of years. So certainly we're not territorial on the use of these tools. It would be silly and unethical for us to be so territorial.
Yeah. And we fully recognize, I mean, I'm speaking for both of us here, that wherever people come from, they bring their unique skill sets and offerings to the equation. And, you know, I love that about this space, is that it's a very multidisciplinary, collaborative one.
Yeah. Absolutely. So maybe it would be nice to start with why. Like, why are people attracted to, maybe therapists in particular, working in this space, working with these psychedelic tools? What sparks the curiosity for people?
It's interesting what's happened in that light, what's happened to the field of psychiatry since I went into it about 14 years ago when I finished my training. Well, actually, even further, when I decided to do a psychiatry residency coming out of med school, it was not a popular idea, right? And it was not hard to get a spot. Like, there were these other specialties like dermatology, radiology, certain like orthopedic surgery that were really competitive and popular. But now there's, I hear from some med students that psychiatry is the new dermatology. And it's not 100% due to the psychedelic renaissance, but that is a major factor.
Right.
And it has become more and more competitive. And I've never seen anything like it in this field, the interest in working in it. It's quite exciting, actually.
Yeah, I've got, from the clinical psychologist perspective, I have a lot of friends went to graduate school with or around the same time who are now asking me, like, hey, you're into this psychedelic stuff. What's this about? They've read Michael Pollan's book, or they've seen the research coming out of Compass or USONA or MAPS, you know, particularly. And it's caught their eye for sure.
Yeah. So the why is important, because it's not necessarily an easy road, and you want to take that decision carefully. And there are some qualities that we've talked about, we could touch on a little more, that are important to develop. But I guess that's one point, is if you want to practice therapy, one prerequisite in general would be, you know, getting licensed as a therapist or prescriber or psychiatrist, psychiatric prescriber. There are a few different disciplines that can do psychotherapy, but that's not the only way to do psychedelic therapy.
Right.
Like we were talking about, there's a role not only for non-therapist facilitators, coaches, guides, but also all the other parts of the ecosystem.
Right. Yeah, I'm glad you said that. And from the therapy side, I was just reflecting on like what got me interested in this particular line of work and this path, this discipline, using these tools. And I remember coming out of the military, you know, Air Force psychologist for a few years, jumped into a small group practice and started seeing a lot of therapy clients. You know, I talked about this a little bit before, but I got a little burned out. And part of that was because of how many clients I decided to see. It's unwise to overburden oneself as a professional helper, mm-hmm. where you're digging from the dregs of your cup to serve others without filling it up yourself. So in the midst of all that, I started to get a little disenchanted with what I could do for people. Mm-hmm. Certainly therapy was helpful for a lot of people, but I was hoping that there was more. And that's when I stumbled across the research. Until then, I'd never even given psychedelics a thought. You know, it wasn't something that was on my radar at all. And then read Michael Pollan's book, started looking more at what research existed at the time, and then had a personal experience with psychedelics that really changed my life. I mean, changed my life personally, but also I remember thinking, like, during a psychedelic experience, oh, this kind of experience, this kind of like unadulterated mindfulness, or mm-hmm. feeling emotions with complete self-compassion and openness. And the perspective that I was experiencing was like, this, I want to bring this to my clients. There's got to be a way to use this psychotherapeutically for all the different reasons one might use psychedelics. This has got to be, I know I can enhance psychotherapy with this tool. So that's kind of what initially brought me, at least sparked my curiosity and excitement about the possibility of psychedelic assisted therapy.
Yeah. So that sparked your interest. And how did you get into it? I mean, I know a lot of this story, but I think it's useful.
You're a big part of that story. So yeah, I started looking for ketamine clinics locally here in Utah where I was practicing, because I learned that, you know, ketamine fell loosely into that broad category of psychedelics and was being used by some people in combination with psychotherapy, also being used just sort of psychiatrically, like we've talked about before, mm-hmm. at ketamine clinics without a lot of therapeutic support. So I found a clinic locally that was doing ketamine and volunteered my services, started working part-time doing, with admittedly not a whole lot of training at the beginning. You know, I didn't go to CIS. I didn't, have specific, psychedelic assisted therapy training when I started at least doing integration work.
Cause it didn't really exist then.
Not a lot.
Yeah.
Not like it does now for sure. Yeah. So I was able to get some reps doing at least integration work, and then started sitting with people during their ketamine experiences. And around that time, you were added to that particular clinic as a part owner. And then we started our relationship and friendship, and learned a lot from you initially on how to do this work.
And likewise, it's been a fun journey. And that's kind of the origin story of the podcast,
yeah.
Right? Is I remember one day we were sitting in clinic where we had offices really close to each other, down in the first Numinous clinic, which was called Cedar Psychiatry at the time. And we were training clinicians. You know, I don't know how many we've trained in our clinic network by now, but we have, you know, well over 100 clinicians mm-hmm. working with us, and others have come and moved on. But I remember while we were developing the training program, this idea emerged of a podcast to support that with mm-hmm. ongoing, like real-time, conversational, good, solid information.
Right. Yeah, and I think we had talked about how much we had enjoyed learning from podcasts generally, and had always wanted to do one. And I think we acknowledged that there was a need for free access to hopefully good information. And there were other great podcasts like Psychedelics Today out there doing the same. But you know, we kind of operate from an abundance mindset. There's always room for more. And so yeah. We decided to dive into it.
Yeah. And it has been focused a lot, in large part, not entirely, on those therapy concepts and medicines in the therapy equation, mm-hmm. things like that. Yeah, it's interesting. Back then, we also, because we were training small groups one-on-one, we decided to film some content and make it asynchronous mm-hmm. for the clinicians who were joining us or who had been working with us but not yet fully trained in ketamine. And we made what, like a 8 to 10 hour online course. Mm-hmm. In that conversational style, these weren't podcast episodes. Those recordings haven't ever been, but that's just as an example, has traditionally been part of the onboarding process for new therapists and prescribers who join our group and start working with ketamine and other medicines. Yeah.
Yeah. So it became kind of the foundation of our training approach, at least for people to have this asynchronous content. Some of it was lecture style, but yeah, a lot of it inspired by our fledgling podcast to have conversations about topics specific at this time to ketamine assisted therapy. So I think we named our course the Foundations of Ketamine Assisted Therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. And now it's probably worth continuing that thread and to what it's become now at Numinous. I know you've been teaching a lot more lately than I have in the fundamentals course, mm-hmm. but we'll talk about lots of different options and general principles, but maybe starting with how that's evolved within our organization, where we do a lot of work with ketamine and Spravato across clinics. I mean, probably I looked the other day, and you know, we'll do 7,000 dosing sessions with Spravato this year, at least 5,000 with ketamine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was so cool to be part of what was Cedar Psychiatry and then Novamind, and then to be acquired by Numinous with their resources and their commitment to training.
Yeah.
Early on. I was really pleased to know that there were already really, really competent, knowledgeable professionals with a lot of experience. So not only commitment to training our staff internally, but to providing training opportunities to the general public. So they were able to sort of shoehorn in the content that we already had and are in the process of developing an entire certification pathway to psychedelic assisted therapy using medicines like ketamine, psilocybin, and MDMA are the three that we're focusing on from a training perspective right now. So that pathway at Numinous starts with that fundamentals course, the mm-hmm. fundamentals of psychedelic assisted therapy, which is a course that, like you said, we've taught, we've already run a few cohorts. The next cohort is starting in October. So if you're listening to this episode, the time that it's released here in October, 2023, you still have time to sign up for the fundamentals course, which is an 8-week course that involves every week asynchronous material, meeting with small groups that we pair you into, put you into, but also attending each week a 3-hour lecture series that's geared to a specific topic for each module.
And I've heard nothing but, to be completely honest and trying not to be biased, but admitting the bias, I've heard nothing but good feedback about it. And, mm-hmm. and I'll acknowledge that there's some damn good training programs out there. And the one part of the equation that we'll dive into at some point is the need for hands-on experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about experiencing the medicine yourself. Like, that's a different topic. But in the mental health and healthcare world, classroom learning only goes so far.
Right.
Yeah. And you need a practicum. You need time in the trenches, and you need supervision and mentorship. Mm. So that's kind of part of this broader pathway, and part of the equation that everyone should keep in mind when they're doing some training is like, where are you going to do the work? Where are you going to learn to do the work and actually work?
Yeah. That was one of the cool things about, you know, being part of Cedar and the Novamind and then now Numinous was that, you know, we have a very active ketamine offering. Mm-hmm. And so new clinicians that came in to work for us, yeah, they would take our asynchronous course, but as part of their onboarding process and training process, they got to observe ketamine treatment, ketamine assisted therapy. So do some shadowing, and then got to have some supervised experience. So we would bring in some volunteer, for example, to provide that hands-on experience, bring in some volunteer ketamine clients who, you know, agreed to be observed and recorded for future educational purposes, and gave our clinicians an opportunity to see it in motion and participate as assisting therapists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to add to your story of how you got into it, reflecting on my training and learning, you know, I've had some great teachers and mentors along the way, including like Phil Wolfson for many years, and so many others. And a lot of my training has come from clinical trials, psychedelic and ketamine clinical trials. Like my first ketamine study was in 2010 for Janssen. And but rewind a few years, you and I were both in the USONA training for psilocybin facilitation before starting their depression study. And then you help Compass train facilitators right now. Having been through that program, we're doing a TRD study right now for Compass, and we just completed the MindMed LSD study. So there was a training, both, you know, some online remote, some at the investigator meeting we flew out to, but every clinical trial using psychedelics, especially the psychedelic assisted psychotherapy approach, will have training as part of it. And what I like about those is the rigor needed, the litmus test of passing regulatory approval that's required, that often means, besides a lot of hoops to jump through and red tape, it often means these have been well developed and pass the test of a lot of scrutinizing eyes looking at it, including, you know, the powers that be, the governing bodies that regulate these medicines.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of the experts and mentors that we look to and a lot of other people look to have expertise because of their participation in clinical trials, right? Not only designing the studies, but being trained to facilitate in those studies and now becoming trainers themselves. And thinking about some of my mentors at MAPS or that have worked on MAPS clinical trials, like Chantel Thomas or Bruce and Marcella.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of my training since I started this work has come in the form of clinical trial training. Apart from MAPS, I'm certified MAPS MDMA assisted therapy training that I went to was not part of their clinical trial. They were already wrapping up clinical trials by the time I got trained. But
yeah, and my MAPS training was because of the clinical trial I was working on, the eating disorder study, and it was just kind of a step in that process, getting plugged into the training that I had not yet done. This is a few years ago now, but that's one pathway to consider, is if you want to work in psychedelic therapy, given where the field is at right now, with only ketamine being legal across all states, and the other medicines coming down the kind of regulatory approval pipeline, MDMA, then psilocybin, et cetera. If you want to work in this space and get damn good training, that's one pathway, is work with a group doing clinical trials in psychedelics.
Right.
Yeah.
And as big as that that opportunity is nowadays, it still is fairly limited, right? You got to find a site that's doing the clinical trials. There aren't a ton of those sites across the world. There are enough of them though, that a lot of people are getting good training.
Yeah.
So like you said, one pathway.
There were maybe 11 sites in the USONA study. We just published that paper. It was a JAMA paper the other day and it describes it, but, and then in the MindMed study, I don't know if there were a couple dozen sites.
Yeah, I was gonna say 20 something.
Yeah. And in the Compass, maybe 40 plus, planned or at least. So, it is a very limited number. As if you were to look at this, the list of MAP sites, that's, like you said, kind of a different list because the phase three studies are done and now it's kind of regulatory submission time. So, this conversation will be a little different next year, mm-hmm. assuming MDMA gets approved like we all think it will, say early next year, and we hopefully are giving it in clinic. You can look to the treatment centers. There will presumably be a registry or database of where to seek MDMA therapy for PTSD, and that would be a good place to look at where to go get mentorship or work. And that is a bit of a separate discussion than the actual training. Like, you can seek out trainings, but the question becomes, what do you do after you complete, especially like a private training or one from a professional association?
Yeah. Yeah. What does it allow you to do? Because speaking specifically about MDMA there, because it hasn't been FDA approved yet, we don't have any like official sanctioned training organizations that can give you a license to practice or whatever you would call it, a certification to practice MDMA assisted therapy specifically. That'll probably be dictated by MAPS, and MAPS is in talks with a variety of organizations to offer those trainings. We're one of those organizations.
Yeah.
And even we will say it with the Numinous training, we call it a certification pathway. That is to say, you'll have a Numinous certification to do psychedelic assisted therapy. And all the good training sites that I go on, like the Vital Training Program from Psychedelics Today, for example, will say, you know, this is what our certification will allow you to do given the state of the industry right now, but this is what it doesn't necessarily allow you to do.
These aren't programs that license you to be a therapist or right. a clinical professional by state standards with, and it's kind of, muddy waters and a changing landscape in some ways, because if you look at the state programs coming out, like Oregon mm-hmm. has its own approved facilitator trainings, but there still are the prerequisite and the required, licenses by maybe one of the facilitators in some cases. But do you remember how that landed for Oregon?
So they do have a list of approved trainings on their website. And man, I might be wrong about this, but I think they say, I should have fact checked this yeah. before, but like that you need to be a licensed professional. If you're going to do, it might be different in Oregon because they're calling like psilocybin services. And there is sort of a lower bar to cross, if I remember right.
But I guess the point is that in the dyad model, especially, and I can speak to clinical trials because we do a lot of those, is the sponsor of the study, like MAPS, for example, or USONA, will submit a protocol to the FDA, the Ethics Committee, and all that. And it might say, we're going to have two facilitators, one with a license, one with not, and this is the kind of license,
right.
Doctoral level, master's level, or not. And then in the protocol review and revision stage, there's a lot of back and forth, a lot of debate. And so that's something else to keep in mind, and that is still evolving. We know how it's landed for the clinical trials that have started, at mm-hmm. least, and have been completed. But we, like you said, we don't know what the final approval by the FDA, assuming they approve it, MDMA, will say, but we have a pretty good guess based mm-hmm. on how the studies were done, how the training was done. And so if you are wanting to work in the dosing room, in the trenches, doing psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, I guess the answer is you don't have to be a licensed professional to work in that setting, but if you are, it opens a lot of doors.
Yeah, especially if you take seriously what we're calling it, psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, it makes sense that you would be a licensed psychotherapist, right? In the States, at least, you can't call yourself a psychotherapist without a license. You can call yourself a coach. You can say what you do is trauma-informed, for example. But to say that you're providing psychotherapy is protected by a licensing board.
And because these are Schedule I controlled substances, or even in the case of ketamine, like a Schedule III controlled prescribable substance, because they're controlled, they need to be prescribed. Mm-hmm. And there needs to be a prescriber in the equation. But that, in psychedelic studies and in the real world, that doesn't mean the prescriber is in the room doing the psychedelic therapy. Sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. But we've certainly had psychedelic studies where I've been the prescriber down the hall, or I need to be available within reach of the clinic, but there are two non-prescriber therapists in the room doing the dosing session for 12 hours, let's say, on an LSD study. So that's another nuance, that if you're not in the field navigating those licensure hurdles and regulatory issues, then you might not have a feel for how that works.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are even organizations like Journey Clinical that will provide for you the prescriber piece as a therapist, where, you know, you partner with them, your client meets with one of their prescribers online, they get a prescription for ketamine, and then, the prescriber is accountable to the medical clearance and the prescribing of the medicine. And then you as a therapist do the ketamine assisted therapy. So this is a prescriber, not available in all states, but a prescriber who isn't even local.
That's kind of like when you mentioned how you got into it. It's a good entry point, is doing the integration for people who are getting the medicine and dosing session elsewhere is one option. Like, someone can go to a clinic for a ketamine dosing session, then come to your therapy practice, in theory, the next day for the integration session, in this collaborative care model.
Right.
Like, we do a lot of that in the community with our ketamine offerings and clinics, and with the network of therapists and prescribers and friends of Numinous or all those taking care of our clients, where we can work together on the course of therapy.
Right. Yeah. So maybe it also would pay off just to back up and reiterate that one of the things to focus on if you want to get into the psychedelic therapy profession is to become a really good therapist first.
Yeah.
Right. So especially the people who are in college right now, who maybe haven't entered the profession yet, but are interested. Sometimes I'll get emails and people say, like, hey, I'm a high school student, or I'm an undergraduate, I'm really interested in this. What program should I go to? And there are a few programs, like graduate school programs, that will do concurrently education in psychedelics, or transpersonal psychology or something like that, that pairs well. But usually what I tell people is focus on getting really, really good psychotherapy training. You know,
yeah,
get a bag of tools and techniques and a philosophy that makes sense. And that can be a good place to start and focus your energies.
Yeah. And maybe it helps to, just outline a little bit what it takes to become a psychotherapist, because there are numerous paths, mm-hmm. and what it takes to become a prescriber or a psychiatric prescriber. Do you want to take the therapist one first?
Yeah. Yeah. So lots of different paths lead to that eventual realm of psychotherapist.
Licensed to do psychotherapy. Yeah.
Yeah. At least in the United States, there are master's level degrees and there are doctoral level degrees that you can get that give you that license. So I'm a clinical psychologist, which is arguably the most arduous path, just a PhD in clinical psychology, or a PsyD. So a PhD, doctor of philosophy, often awarded in programs that have a research orientation. So you'll write a dissertation. The program I went to was both a clinical and research focus. So it was a mm-hmm. scientist practitioner model.
You did the PhD, but if you do a PsyD, do you need to do a thesis?
You do need to do some kind of thesis.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just not as rigorous as a dissertation.
Not as kind of research oriented, perhaps. Right.
And their cohorts are generally larger. You know, my PhD cohort was 12, 14 people or so. And wow. I have some friends who graduated from PsyD cohorts of hundreds of people. Those are usually professional schools, meaning they cost a lot more because their tuition isn't subsidized by a research program. And some of the fancy PhD programs like will give you a pretty hefty stipend.
What does it cost these days? Because I have a daughter in college, so I'm really familiar with the skyrocketing costs of undergraduate education.
Yeah.
And master's and doctoral programs just get, in general, more expensive than that, right?
Yeah, I don't have a pulse on the current price. I know that mine was relatively cheap because I went to Brigham Young University and at the time was a member of that church, the church, you know, the LDS church that owns that organization. So it was cheaper. I still had to take out student loans. But I had some colleagues in my internship cohort. For a clinical psychologist, your last year is kind of like a physician's residency. You go somewhere else on site and full-time training and practice. And who did the PsyD route, and they came out with six figures in student loan debt.
Which would be the norm and very expected these days is like, if you do a PsyD or even PhD, it's going to cost you six figures. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's really hard to work in parallel. Like people do in general student loans for these things. Right. The same applies to med school. But like you mentioned in your internship, you start to get paid a little bit. Right.
Yeah.
Just like in residency. So, just to recap, the PhD route, PsyD route take about 4 years after undergrad for the education.
4 to 6, yeah.
Depending. And then your internship, another year, X number of hours in general.
And then some people will do a postdoc after that. Mostly that's people who are doing the research sort of path. But that's the more expensive, more time consuming. I don't regret it though. You know, being Dr. Steve has opened some doors for me that not being Dr. Steve probably wouldn't have.
Dr. Steve.
Yeah.
Cool.
So then there's the master's path, and that's a lot of different degrees. So marriage and family therapy, licensed clinical social worker, licensed professional counselor. Licensed professional counselor, I think, is the one in Utah. What's the equivalent elsewhere? It's like a master's in mental health counseling.
They go by a lot of different names. And even in the PhD, you can go to an educational psychology program and still practice psychotherapy, right?
Yeah. So mine was a PhD in clinical psychology, but at the same university, they had a PhD program in the education department for counseling psychologists.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a wash. Like once you get your doctorate, whether it's a counseling or clinical psychology PhD, you're basically licensed to do the same things.
And more we'll see academic institutions, universities, that have psychedelic medicine as part of their offering or part of those programs. Now that there are programs at universities and research departments, like Hopkins being a great example, NYU, Columbia, Berkeley, etc. We can talk about some of these, but that's another filter to pass it through is, if you want to be a psychedelic therapist, and you want to do this route we're talking about of becoming a licensed therapist, it's not required to go somewhere that will give you psychedelic therapy training. You can add that on in the workplace and via outside trainings. But if it is integrated in your training program, of course, that can be a big added bonus.
Right. Yeah. Another thing I wanted to say about the doctoral route, the earning potential for a doctoral level therapist isn't that much more than the earning potential for a master's level therapist.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like a physician, right? Most physicians come out of med school. Psychiatrists aren't the highest paid physicians in the world, right? Probably among the lowest paid. But so a lot of my colleagues were struggling in their early career to pay back those student loans. So just something to consider if you wanted to go whole hog and do the doctoral level route.
Because a master's is going to take about half the time, right? 2 years?
2-3, yeah.
Plus internship or clinical hours.
Exactly, yeah. Post-graduation clinical hours, supervised clinical hours before licensure is another thing to keep in mind. Depending on the state that you're licensed in, it can be a year, again, a year to two. Social workers have a from what I understand, like a huge supervision burden.
Like 3,000 to 5,000 hours
yeah.
to get licensed as a therapist after your grad school.
Right.
So you need to find somewhere to work at a, usually a reduced rate, mm-hmm. right? And that, and have a supervisor who you meet with at least weekly, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, some states will allow you to count your internship hours toward that total. Mm-hmm. So you still haven't technically graduated with your degree yet. You're sort of all but dissertation, they say. So yeah, those are some things to consider.
Yeah. Yeah. And, so on the prescribing front, if you want to be a psychiatrist, you have to go to med school, which is 4 years. And, then the residency after that, you know, if you can get a spot, it's a 4-year residency program. There are combined programs that are 5 years with child and adolescent, for example, or people sometimes do, you know, add it on after their residency if they're doing that subspecialty. There's subspecialties in addiction medicine, et cetera, et cetera. But there are other routes into psychiatric prescribing. Like you could be a psychiatric nurse practitioner, which means you work, you get your nursing degree first. BSN is usually required, and then go to a master's program, or you can be a physician assistant and gravitate towards psychiatry. PA schools don't usually have a, there isn't that I know of a psychiatric PA program, but right. we have a lot of stellar PAs on our team who have gotten added training after becoming a PA and gotten on the job experience and damn good training. So master's level prescribers is another path that's a lot quicker than med school, which still has its you know, internship, clinical hours, vary state by state, et cetera. But the difference there worth noting is that in general, and this depends on the state, is physician assistants need to work with and technically under an MD. Mm-hmm. And as an MD, I can have, I think, 4 full-time equivalent PAs I'm working with. Whereas a nurse practitioner does not. They could hang their shingle, at least in Utah and many states, they can work independently. And it does vary widely by state. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So do you think that there might eventually be a subspecialty for psychedelic medicine for psychiatrists? Like you might have that add-on you talked about for child and adolescent. Maybe there'll be an add-on for, or a full residency.
Yeah, maybe. there's talk of it, but the thing about psychedelic medicine and psychedelic therapy is it is for mental health, for all intents and purposes. I know it's being studied for other things like, you know, TBI and headache and yeah. pain. So I realize that statement is limited, but practically speaking, right now, the clinical trials that are furthest along, it does live in these worlds of psychotherapy, psychology, psychiatry, general mental health, and there are no, I don't think there will be a residency program, like a core residency program for psychedelics. Programs are offering more and more psychedelic medicine as part of it. And some have like, are talking about or launching certificate programs. But I think what will happen more likely is it becomes a fellowship afterwards. Like you can, at some of these top-notch psychedelic research institutions, you can do a postdoc or fellowship program there. And that would be after you get your initial residency done. But these are, I mean, the disclaimer for this whole episode is a lot of this is speculative.
Right.
And we're just, you know, relaying on, you know, what we've learned by working in this space and being in this space and taking our best guess of how it's going to unfold. And it's a changing landscape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about what people might also run across when they're looking for training. And that is for non-licensed therapists or non-clinicians, usually falls under that category of coach, right? Mm-hmm. So you'll find psychedelic coaching programs out there. And most of them are oriented toward prep and integration. Some of them will be as bold as to to train people to hold space and actually facilitate medicine journeys. But lots of different coaching programs. And the ones I've taken a look at, some of them are actually really good. Very professional, created by and led by experienced people. Most of them getting their experience in the ceremonial context out of the country at things like ayahuasca ceremonies or mushroom ceremonies.
Yeah.
But they can provide pretty good containers.
And that reminds me, it's not like we're talking about, you don't have to become a psychotherapist or a licensed prescriber to work in the space, but you definitely do not. But those do open doors. I wanted to point out that some of my like MAPS mentors and some of the top MAPS therapists and trainers, like Bruce Poulter, is a nurse by background.
And a massage therapist.
Yeah, yeah.
Bodywork background.
But he was such a good mentor and such a good psychedelic therapist too. Mm-hmm. And his partner, Marcella Adelora, is a master's level therapist. Mm-hmm. Michael Mithoffer is a psychiatrist. I think he was an ER doc who later did a residency in psychiatry as well. And is Annie, his wife, a nurse by background?
Nurse, yeah, I think so. And there's a lot of marriage and family therapists in there, both masters. That's also one that you can get both a master's and a PhD in and still be a licensed therapist.
Yeah, like my MAPS small group mentor, Ann Wagner, I believe is a PhD, but in marriage and family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She did the couples PTSD, conjoint PTSD therapy study in Toronto, which think was super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm reminded of our podcast with Rachel Harris, Swimming in the Sacred and listening to ayahuasca.
Yeah.
And, you know, the attention that she draws to a different kind of approach to holding space or guiding people with this apprenticeship model, right?
That yeah.
Especially in indigenous contexts where if you were going to hold space for somebody or have somebody sit with you on the medicine, that, you know, you needed to have lots of medicine journeys yourself. You need to apprentice with an experienced shaman or guide for years and years and years before you even, you know, dared to hold that space for somebody else. And a lot of these really good training programs are bringing in the perspective of you know, non-Western mental health professionals, but people who carry the wisdom and the lineage of indigenous traditions to help inform those of us who mm-hmm. are newer to this space.
You can't get it all in a classroom, that's for sure. And, you know, we've been working with new clinicians, helping train for quite some time, and you know, it's so common that people come in just wide-eyed, excited, and scared mm-hmm. because you don't know what's going to come up. It's the nature of the field. Like, what about difficult experiences? We can talk about them all we want till we're blue in the face in classroom, but until you're there doing it or watching your colleague, mentor, co-facilitator do it and talking about it after and then trying it on with support and confidence by having, you know, by having that kind of training support, you really don't know what you're getting into until you actually get into the work.
Right. Yeah. It makes me think of those essential qualities that if you want to be a psychedelic guide, facilitator, therapist, that one might want to have. We did a whole podcast episode on mm-hmm. Janice Phelps's competencies.
Yeah.
And we go over those in the Numinous Fundamentals of Psychedelic Assisted Therapy course as well. So we won't dive deep into those, but maybe it'll help read if we just list them real quick.
Yeah, I love the name of the first one, Empathetic Abiding Presence.
Yeah. Which a lot of these are, I would say, are competencies for any therapist, but specifically helpful for people doing the psychedelic work. So
yeah,
empathetic abiding presence.
Yeah, when you're in a session, and I think you're really great at this, by the way,
thank
Steve.
You.
you maintaining your presence and attunement to the client and the energy of their emotions, their body, the room during the session. That's kind of what it's alluding to. Sensing, empathizing, responding, resonating with them, with your whole self.
Yeah, being attuned. I remember I had a client once pull their eye mask off after 3 hours and just look at me and be like, do you ever get bored? Because it was an inward experience for them. They were silent for 3 or 4 hours. And sure, I experienced boredom, but I reassured them that, I spent a lot of hours as a kid ice fishing with my father, which involves a pole with a line in the hole, doing nothing for a long time, waiting for something to happen. Oh. So yeah, I've flexed that muscle a lot.
Let's put that on the training list.
must have an experiential with ice fishing.
Ice fishing. Yeah.
The second one is trust enhancement. Certainly you want to create a good therapeutic rapport based on a firm foundation of trust, right?
Yeah.
Like you said, not only is it can be a little nerve wracking for a therapist to go into this space, but for our clients, understandably, a lot of questions, a lot of nervousness, especially if they've never had an altered state experience. So the things that you can do to increase trust are really important.
Yeah. I really like the third one too. Spiritual intelligence. Mm. Yeah. It's a kind of a favorite term of mine these days.
We talk a lot about it in the fundamentals course. When I think about spiritual intelligence, it's not necessarily religious, right? We make the distinction between religious ideology adherence and what we're talking about here with spiritual intelligence. But how do you think about spiritual intelligence?
I love the term transpersonal, just anything outside of the confines of our individual kind of human physical body and the unknowable, if you will, the transcendent, like the, it can mean a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Another one here, knowledge of the physical and psychological effects of psychedelics seems self-explanatory. It's important that you understand the tools that you're working with. You sort of mentioned in passing whether or not a psychedelic therapist should have their own altered state experiences. It's a question that's debated, but most people in the industry that I've talked to says at the very least, it's very, very helpful to know the inner space and the cosmic space of a psychedelic altered experience before you help somebody through such an experience.
Yeah. And that's a discussion debate we've had many a times, including on past episodes, but it's a fun one that we won't go down that rabbit hole for now.
Right. Therapist self-awareness and ethical integrity. Again, you should have that on board and well rehearsed and understood if you're going to be a therapist at all, but really important because there's some interesting ethical, questions that come up when you're doing this work where somebody is very vulnerable, emotionally and physically vulnerable on psychedelics.
Yeah. And check out the code of ethics that MAPS has put out. It's really good. And well-developed, and there are a number of them out there. Check out the code of ethics for the professional societies that you're thinking of working in, like of a psychotherapist or a physician, for example.
Yeah. The last one of Phelps's guidelines, proficiency in complementary techniques. We've talked about this on the show a bit. It's not that there is one particular therapeutic orientation or set of techniques that is absolutely pairs well with psychedelics. There are a few that the researchers who've done the research up until now have had biases toward and that you'll see show up in like Compass's psychological support model or the MAPS model or the, Yale model for psilocybin assisted therapy heavily bends toward acceptance and commitment therapy and experiential avoidance and things like that.
But these can mean like breathing practices, guided meditations, body scans,
somatic awareness. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Trauma informed for sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we could go, there's so much more content to cover here. I actually have to run here pretty quick to go train some psychedelic therapists So maybe we'll do a part two, especially as Numinous continues to evolve our training and treatment or our training offerings. We mentioned MAPS, the potential partnership with MAPS coming up, but just real quickly, we are offering the Fundamentals of Psychedelic Assisted Therapy course. In that certification pathway, there's also an Applied Psychedelic Assisted Therapy course where we talk about specific cases, conditions, specific medicines, and then an asynchronous course, I think it's called Molecular Foundations, where people can do a deep dive into some of these different molecules that we use.
Cool. And one more thing I'll throw out there is just kind of on a personal self-awareness note is, I think I've mentioned the hedgehog principle on the podcast before from Jim Collins in a book, Good to Great, decades ago, but he has these three overlapping circles, like a Venn diagram, if you will, to help find your career path. And one of them is what lights you up, like follow your bliss. What do you love? and say, so you love psychedelic therapy. There's one, and like you said, why, you know, one part of it, what are you really good at? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you have a degree in, 10,000 hours under your belt, whatever. And the third important one is what could drive your economic engine? What could actually pay the bills? And at the intersection of there is kind of a clue of where to look, because this space needs a lot more than just therapists, psychiatrists. There are study coordinators. We've talked about space holders, but what about everything else, from like accounting to marketing to content creation, right? Even Michael Pollan has a new program out of Berkeley for journalists working in psychedelics. So the field is white and vast.
Yeah. Yeah. It's important that not one of those circles is out of balance or missing, right? Because you can imagine somebody who has a lot of technical skill, but they don't like doing it, right? I think, you know, this is a profession that is calling people who are passionate about it, who are very, very interested about it, and who want to serve using those tools such that they can make enough money to pay their bills. So yeah. It's important that those three things are in alignment.
And I should clarify, the field is white and ready to harvest is some like pioneer term.
But yeah, maybe a biblical scriptural reference perhaps. Well, cool. Well, I got to run. Thanks for the conversation, Reed. Maybe we'll do a part two here pretty soon.
Okay. See you, Steve.
Bye. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify, subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.